From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. When you talk about personal computers, you're either talking about an IBM PC or PC clone, or you're talking about the Macintosh. Today, we're going to be talking about different aspects of both of them. Stephen Levy has studied diverse areas of technology, from computer hackers to artificial life, from data privacy to data piracy. Today, we'll talk to him about the legendary beginnings of the Macintosh computer. I'll also speak with Larry Magid, a syndicated columnist with the Los Angeles Times. He writes a regular feature called Computer File. We'll talk about the art of explaining the IBM PC to the roughly half of us who are wary of computers. And we'll talk about his involvement with the Polyclass kidnap case. Stephen Levy has written a new book, Insanely Great, The Life and Times of the Macintosh, the computer that changed everything. It's been 10 years since Apple introduced the Mac, so I asked Stephen to recall for us what made the Macintosh so revolutionary.
Previously, computers went out to individuals. They had personal computers, and that was a really big advance that people had them and they could interact with them. But there was always kind of a barrier between people and their information. You had to use these codes, which were really a carryover from the old days of computing when you had to actually submit cards to someone to get results. And this was, you know, the personal computers were more interactive. You could, you know, communicate with them yourselves, but you never really felt at ease with your information because you had to use these esoteric codes, and the screens were very ominous. They were dark, and these glowing letters came out of it. And then along came this computer that was looked different than anything else. It was, you know, it was looked almost like this box, you know, friendly like box sitting on your desktop, taking up no more room than a piece of paper. And you looked at it, and it looked like a piece of paper on the screen. It was dark letters against a white background, and the expression "what you see is what you get" came into vogue with that, because what you apprehended on your computer screen was exactly what you would see when you printed it out. There was no difference between text and graphics. You could manipulate it, and you could get your hands on your information. It was really a marvelous breakthrough, not really devised at Apple, but packaged in a way where people could use it. And it had an attitude. It really came at you with a smiling face and a bomb if things went wrong. And it was different than anything that, you know, people had been able to get their hands on before, and made a difference, I think.
We often think of technology as being the hardware, that's the physical equipment, and the software, the computer programs, and we buy a lot of those applications. But in fact, a major part of the technology on the Macintosh is this user interface, is
right.
the graphics. Now, because most people first saw this technology on the Mac, I think a lot of people assume this technology was first developed at Apple, but it was evolving for some time. Tell us about how that interface evolved.
Sure. Actually, I date the whole set of ideas that culminated in the Macintosh is beginning in 1945. When a fellow named Vannevar Bush, who was the science advisor to Roosevelt, actually, came up with an idea anticipating the end of World War II, saying, well, we've made these great advances in science, but how are they really going to help people? And what he thought the big advance of the late part of the 20th century was going to be the manipulation of information to create almost a Valhalla, a nirvana, where people would bring themselves up and educate themselves and have access to data. The great libraries of Alexandria would come rise up out of the Atlantean void and be accessible to everyone. And he actually invented an imaginary machine called the Memex, which would do this. And his ideas were published in the Atlantic Monthly in an essay which has become very famous called As We May Think. And it reached the Philippine Islands. This is a bizarre story, where a young naval lieutenant, I believe, named Douglas Engelbart was waiting to come home from the war. And it just really enchanted him. And he returned home, got a PhD. In the early 50s, he thought, what am I going to do with my life? And he thought, well, I'm going to put these ideas into action. He got a job at a place called the Stanford Research Institute and actually invented himself a lot of the ideas that people would see in a Mac, things like the mouse, you know, that little pointing device that you hold in your hand that moves the cursor on the screen, and things like Windows on a computer screen. When you think about it, Windows are actually kind of profound. It's a box on a screen, which is literally a window into another world where your information lives. And it moves around, and behind that window, it's almost like Alice through the Looking Glass, you can go in and get your things. And he implemented this in a very complicated system that he enrolled in the late 60s at this one demonstration at a computer conference that it was almost like a Grateful Dead performance. And, ironically, Stuart Brand, the Whole Earth Catalog fellow, was one of the technicians helping run the thing. It didn't make much of a splash. It was kind of limited to a small circle. But those ideas later migrated off to a place called the Xerox PARC, the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which was an attempt by a very big company, Xerox, to implement these ideas into computers that anyone could use. But Xerox, as a big company, couldn't put those out into the marketplace. And it wasn't until late 1979, in a very notorious incident, where some engineers from this upstart company called Apple got permission to visit Xerox PARC. And I call that visit really the biggest heist since the Brinks job. they went in there, and it was all perfectly legal because Xerox, the bean counters there, thought they really weren't giving anything away to let the people from Apple come in. But these guys, who were kind of street hackers, technicians of a rebel stripe, came in there and they saw these ideas, which were really developed in academia. The government helped support this research, never got out to the public. And when these folks, who as a personal computer company, their job was to get things out of the public, they saw these things, Steve Jobs and his crew, their eyes went like saucers, and they left with the future in their heads.
Well, Steve Jobs was the legendary leader of the Mac project. His goal was to develop a computer that was insanely great, the title of your book. What could this possibly mean, and what effect did it have on the design of the Macintosh?
Right. The insanely great thing really gives a window into Steve's personality. Greatness would be something that Steve would be very unhappy with. It had to be just insanely great, right? The superlative superlative. Steve actually entered the Macintosh era with sort of an inferiority complex. Even though he was the leading entrepreneur in America, he had helped market the Apple II computer, which was the first very popular personal computer, but felt he didn't get the credit he deserved because most people knew that it was really designed by his co-founder, Steve Wozniak. And he wanted to make a mark himself. He felt that he wanted to do something which would make his mark on history. He even used the expression to put a dent in the universe. Unfortunately, not long after that visit to Xerox PARC that I mentioned, the ideas that the Apple technicians saw at Xerox, they were putting into effect on a more expensive computer called the Lisa. And Steve was working on that project, but people got a little impatient with him. They felt he didn't have the experience and the maturity to run a project like that. So they basically threw him off the project. And Steve looked around at Apple, the company which he co-founded, and saw this little skunk works. It wasn't even in the main buildings. It was in this little place near a gas station, and they called Texaco Towers after the gas station. And there were five people working in there, led by a fellow named Jeff Raskin, a very fanciful fellow who had in his contract at Apple that he had to have time off to work at the to attend rehearsals of the chamber opera in San Francisco, of which he was the head. And he had some very specific ideas about having a computer, a little computer, like a Swiss Army knife that people could use for anything. Well, Steve came over, and he liked this idea. He liked this concept of a lift computer, that people could use something low cost. But he wanted to bring those Xerox Lisa ideas over and essentially muscled Raskin off the project and put his mark on it. And, he was an amazing, charismatic cheerleader, browbeater who got that project going.
What was he like when he managed the project?
Steve had a dark side, which came out when he was motivating. It wasn't only, you know, using the carrot. You know, sometimes he would say, hey, if you get this screen thing running by midnight, we'll all order pineapple pizza, you know, like at Frankie and Johnny's, and everyone would work very hard and they'd get the pizza. But he also, you know, would just walk around, see, look over people's shoulders, and, you know, say, this really is junk, you know, or in stronger terms than that, let's say. he would challenge people. He was very contentious, and you know, sometimes, not really knowing what he was saying, you know, he would challenge someone on a technical aspect that even he didn't understand. But he would have a prejudice. The fellow who he elbowed off the project, Jeff Raskin, used to complain that, you know, whoever the last person Steve talked to was, you know, Steve's greatest influence. He also said Steve practiced something called management by walking around, where, you know, you'd hear these footsteps behind you, and, you know, and there would be Steve. Though sometimes, you know, the team understood this. They knew when to push him. There was one item in particular that Steve was adamant on was the kind of disk drive the computer would use. And the group knew that Steve was pushing a bad standard there. So what they actually did is they actually started a relationship with Sony, who was coming out with this new kind of small 3.5-inch disk drive that was sturdier and held more information. And they did this hiding it from Steve. At one point, they literally hid an engineer from Sony in the closet when Steve came. And, you know, when the other disk drive turned out to be not reliable, then they said to Steve, oh, yes, well, we've been talking to Sony, and there's other ones already. And Steve was smart enough to say, well, gee, maybe we better take a look at that one.
My guest today is Stephen Levy. He is the author of a new book on the birth of the Macintosh computer. It's entitled Insanely Great, and you may remember him from his 1984 book, Hackers, the Heroes of the Computer Revolution, and the more recent Artificial Life. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Well, there's no doubt that the Macintosh-like interface has been supremely successful. This is essentially the same interface that we now see on the IBM PC with Windows. And this user interface was touted as changing the way you think. That's what we're talking about. Does this way of interacting with a computer really change the way you think, or was it immediately successful because it's much closer to the way we do think?
I think, to take it in order, first of all, yes, I think it does change the way we think. When earlier I referred to this barrier between yourself and your information in previous computers, it really affected the way that you worked and the way you viewed the information you were working with. You didn't really see it as part of your life, but something stored away somewhere in some virtual warehouse somewhere else that you had to drive your mental truck up to the door of the warehouse and, you know, put in the request for the information, and then you were allowed to, you know, work on it for a little while, then send it back there. You have this barrier of commands between you and the information. Well, the Macintosh used these metaphors that enabled you to see the information almost like a virtual reality world. When you turn on a Macintosh, there's a virtual desktop, a virtual office with a little picture of you know, the hard drive, and that's where your folders live. And just like in a full filing cabinet, you have folders, and you have documents in the folder, and if you want to get rid of the document, you throw it in a little trash can. Well, that's a metaphor, of course. There's no real trash can in there on one hand. On the other hand, when you're dragging with using the mouse a document over to the trash can, you're really throwing it out. I actually started reading when I was doing Insanely Great some linguists named Lakoff and Johnson, and they wrote a lot about the use of metaphors changing the way we think. For instance, we have a metaphor for argument, which, you know, concerns war, and saying, you know, using strategies for debate and things like that, and that actually affects the way we conduct conversations. You know, we're very contentious with each other. In the same way, you know, the metaphors of the desktop affect the way you view your information when you use it on the Mac. Now, the second part of what you say is kind of interesting in terms of acceptance immediately, because people didn't accept it immediately. It was almost too drastic. The original Macintosh came out. One obstacle was that it was not sufficiently powerful enough to, you know, use these very sophisticated tools. It was a little ahead of what computers could do at that time. It took a little while to catch up. And people rightly complained about that. But there was another bias against it that went a little deeper. I think people, particularly the people who had investment in the previous paradigm, were scared of the Macintosh, and they charged that, well, this looks like a toy with all these pictures and things like that. But what they were really resisting was this idea of people getting close to their information and, you know, essentially shutting out the computer establishment, which really held the keys to the information warehouse that we referred to before. It's interesting to see now that these objections have totally evaporated when, as you say, you know, with Windows and other things, the Macintosh paradigm, the idea of using metaphors to get hold of your information, is really dominant. And I think the ultimate legacy of the Macintosh is going to be bringing that metaphoric response to information to the people in general. And we're going to see it not only in computers, but people are going to talk to their television sets and telephones using those same techniques.
Let's talk about the environment of the Macintosh project team. It's been described by some as a cult environment. What was it like?
It was, it had certain aspects of a cult. But I think it's unfair to call it that, because if to call Steve Jobs a Jim Jones kind of leader, would be inaccurate. He had them going, and it was always a very small team, no more than a dozen engineers tops. It was kind of a little mini Manhattan Project in blue jeans, let's say, where these people wanted to change the world and believe they could. But I think the difference is that they weren't operating under an illusion. Most small groups who think that, you know, we're going to do something to change everything are deluded. In this case, it wasn't a delusion. They really had their fingers on some sort of pulse. And what they wanted to do was not so much build a computer for an audience, a business audience, or an audience filling this niche or that, but a computer that they really passionately wanted to use themselves. They were their own test market. And Steve really brought that out on them and got them to do beyond their best in doing it. There's one interesting story that gives an indication of how Steve Jobs motivated people. The one big challenge was getting the computer, which was underpowered, as I say, at that time. It didn't have the proper amount of memory. The processing, chip was a little underpowered, so it was a little slow. And they tried to get every ounce of computation out of those chips to make it run as fast as possible. Well, in one case, in startup, the machine was taking a long time. And Steve approached the engineer who was working on that problem, and he said, "I've done all I can." He said, "But listen, if you just get 1 second faster there, you got to figure there's a million people who are going to turn on that machine every day. And if you count the amount of seconds, what's it going to come to? It's going to come to enough seconds to consist of 50 lives. Don't you want to save 50 lives?" Well, that engineer worked for 3 days and got it to go 3 seconds quicker, so we saved 150 lives.
The safety aspect. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Stephen Levy. He's the author of Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, The Computer That Changed Everything. Well, let's talk about some similarities between two whiz kids who are financially successful beyond counting, and that's Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft. They're both known for their rants and their diatribes and their sort of abusive remarks and perhaps insulting interpersonal styles. Is this what it takes to be in the super success category?
Well, I think there's a distinction you have to make between Steve and Bill. Steve thinks of himself more as an artist than Bill does. What's very important, what we haven't talked about here, is the aesthetic of the Mac. Steve always envisioned the Macintosh to have its place in the design collection of the Museum of Modern Art. He considered the people who worked for them not merely engineers, but artists, that they were creating a great work of art, and that this was the great canvas of the 21st century, the computers. I don't think Bill Gates thinks that way. I spent some time with Bill. He's obviously an extremely, extremely bright person, understands business probably better than anyone you can name, and I think his bank account is testament to that. But he doesn't have those pretensions. He really wants to keep up on the technician side, and he still I think maintains a sort of nerdly aspect about him, probably less so in recent years as better people pick out his suits. I don't know, but So I think that there is this distinction. Both of them are very hard-driving people, let's say, extremely hard-working people who expect the same from the people who work for them.
You were talking earlier about rewards like pineapple pizza. The outside of computer equipment is primarily made of injection mold plastics, and the original team signed their names to the mold, which created the inside of the back cover. So if you unscrew one of the old ones, you see the names of the entire team right in there, and I've seen that, which was fun. What were the kind of rewards that the people who worked on this project got?
I think that they felt, Steve actually had an expression saying the journey is the reward. They would have these retreats. They would go to a hotel in Monterey or somewhere down the coast and spend a couple days away from the office where they had all these great toys and they worked all the time. And Steve would write these slogans on the board. And that was one of them. And the other one was, it's better to be a pirate and join the Navy. And that gives an indication of what kind of rewards they were. They weren't getting paid a whole lot of money compared to starting their own company, which any of them could do, and many of them did afterwards and, became quite rich. What they were getting paid at Apple was relatively slave wages, maybe in the, $30,000-$40,000 range, compared to what they were bringing into Apple, that's really nothing. But they felt that they were going to make a dent in the universe. That was their goal, and they were so excited about changing the world, being artists, that they worked double, triple times, and that was their life. They realized that it was a great sacrifice they were making for humanity, and also that was virtually all their lives. So for them, the journey really was the reward, and by the time they finished, they were all so burned out that it took much longer for Apple to make the revisions in the computer to bring it up to speed, to respond to some flaws that it had in the initial version, because the whole team was really unable to go on after they did it. It was like they sprinted and they collapsed at the finish line.
I was interested in your telling about how midway through the project, the software director left and was replaced by Bob Belleville, who you've described as a former Xerox PARC engineer, so we know he was part of the evolution that came, and he was in his 30s, soft-spoken, very deliberate, very professional. And here he is, the software director, and you described him as being incredibly despised by the software people. In fact, Andy Hertzfeldt, who was the major operating system developer, ROM developer, would go into venomous anti-Belleville tirades even 10 years later. Why was that?
He was kind of like the Margaret Dumont character in the Marx Brothers. It really was a case where, the people working on them, people like Andy Hertzfeldt and Burl Smith, and Bill Atkinson, were technological geniuses. Steve Jobs pampered them because he knew that he could get work out of them that could be unmatched anywhere else in the world. Bob came out there, as an older fellow, a little more acclimated to an orderly regime. And, he made some really excellent contributions, but, his management style was such that, he attempted to rein in some of the excesses there. This just did not work. It didn't fit in with the culture of that small pirate group, right? It's you can imagine someone on a pirate ship saying, well, let's punch the time clock now. It wasn't all that great a fit, and, it wound up with Andy Hertzfeldt in particular becoming very disenchanted. And even now, 10 years later, he still, his eyes well up when he talks about this. Andy's a very passionate person. He really, believes very deeply in what he's doing. And the idea of someone looking over him and for some bureaucratic reason making a suggestion just incenses him. And there was actually kind of a little secret war going on there between the Apple team and the other people, usually outside the Macintosh division, who they considered bozos. That was their general term for it. And they felt that these other people who Apple had been hiring in an attempt to get respectable from companies like Hewlett-Packard and even IBM in some cases, were bozos that they just couldn't cope with. And, what made Andy and Burl, Burl was kind of the Mozart of computer design. He designed the boards that went in the Macintosh, the hardware. What made them leave Apple really was, like a they couldn't handle the bozos.
The chemistry of any team is interesting. If they're really all copacetic, it's almost like they go to sleep. So there needs to somehow be some little catalyst that moves them in different ways. And so you sort of see these. You see this throughout the book, that there are different things that affect it, but it kept moving forward, you know, just relentlessly.
Right, a little past the time that they thought it would be. It was about a year late. I remember I actually visited the Mac team before they came out with a computer, and this was my first exposure to the computer when I was doing a story for Rolling Stone about the launch, and it changed my life. I immediately fell in love with the machine. And I remember Bill Atkinson telling me, he said, it's like running a race where people keep moving the finish line.
Needless to say, if everybody's in their 20s, I love people in their 20s. I was once in my 20s, but you can only have so much experience, whether it's technical or business or life or otherwise. And there were some signs of that in the book, that some parts of the Macintosh Project team and actually Apple Corporation in general either didn't know about or didn't know to be aware of. I love your accounting of Bill Gates commenting on being at Apple the day IBM announced its PC. And they weren't fazed at all. You know, oh, well, you know, they're
right.
Going to buy us.
Well,
you know?
These are people that saw a company from starting in a garage in 1976 and incorporating in 1977, go to, by the time the Macintosh came out, $1 billion a year company. They thought that they had the Midas touch. That they, you know, knew things better than everyone else. This hubris could work to their advantage, as it did with the Macintosh, but in terms of responding to the IBM PC, it was very detrimental to them. They put in a big ad in the Wall Street Journal saying, the day the IBM PC came out, saying, welcome IBM, period. Seriously, period. Well, seriously, IBM, you know, whooped Apple's behind, for years, mainly because they were, you know, able to attract a killer application, the Lotus 1-2-3, and, you know, take on Apple, where Apple had been making inroads into the business market with VisiCalc on the Apple II. By the time Macintosh came out, the war over who would have the dominant share of the personal computer industry was over. IBM won. And what, you know, Macintosh set out to do, and after some hard years of struggle eventually did, was establish a new beachfront, a third standard, after the IBM PC and the Apple II.
Well, at the end you say about the existence of the Macintosh, behold, a dent in the universe. They did it. What exactly is that dent?
I think the dent is to extend, to augment human capabilities by broadening what we do out into the world of information. There is an alternate world where our ideas, our expressions, have always lived in cuneiform and papyrus and paper and vinyl. And by melting it down to a digital lingua franca, we can get access to that. And the Macintosh, by using this idea of metaphor and enabling us to get onto that, have pushed us into the age where we're going to have, you know, intimacy with those forms of our expression. So the big picture is, what the Macintosh does is the first product which really threw us into that world where we could really say we're in the age of information.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest today has been Stephen Levy. He is the author of Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, The Computer That Changed Everything, published by Viking. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Magid writes the syndicated column Computer File. He's well known for being able to explain personal computers to non-technical people. I asked him, what's the trick?
I think the main trick, if you call it that, in explaining personal computing to non-technical people is to be aware that most people have lives and they have things to do besides get into the intricacies of DOS and Windows or Macintosh or whatever it is. And I think when I think about the people I talk with, I think about myself on all those subjects where I'm not an expert, automobiles, sports, a lot of subjects that I'm not an expert in. And if I go into a car dealership and somebody starts talking about rack and pinion steering and, you know, 24 valves and all this stuff, I start glazing over because what I want to know is how much of the car cost, what will it do for me, how long will it last, what will it cost, et cetera. Ultimately, that's what people want to know about computers. So I just try to put myself in their place and realize I'm an intelligent person, and the fact that I don't know about automobiles doesn't mean that I'm not intelligent. I give the assumption that they're an intelligent person, and the fact that they don't know a lot about computers simply means they don't know a lot about computers. So it's just simply an attitude. It's really respecting people, liking people, and being aware that that a technical education is not a precursor to being a good human being.
That's right. Well, your new book, the Little PC Book, is described as a gentle introduction to personal computers. What's different about it?
Well, I think the word gentle is very descriptive. I really, again, assume that my reader is not a dummy, is not stupid, and is caring about wanting to learn about computers, but needs some hand-holding. I did when I first learned about computers. I actually dropped out of a computer class in graduate school halfway through because I felt I had no aptitude. And a friend of mine took me by the hand. This was back in the late 70s when we were sort of jockeying around mainframes. Took me by the hand, and he said, look, it's not that hard. Let me show you what you need to do. And ever since then, I've been reasonably competent around computers. And that experience taught me that you just need to be gentle. You need to be respectful, and you need to say, okay, here's what it is. Keep the jargon to a minimum. When you do use jargon, make sure you explain it in human terms. So, for example, when you're describing hardware, you might describe it like a record player or CD player, and software kind of like records or tapes. And you just use the analogies that people understand. And a lot of analogies. We also, John Grimes, who's an award-winning cartoonist, illustrated the book with some great cartoons. And later I'm going to have you read one of the cartoons out loud because I think it's even funny enough to read out loud. And they're technically accurate, and they do impart information, yet they're light and lively. We did a lot of work. My editors and publisher did a lot of work making sure this book was very smooth and didn't contain material that it didn't need to contain. In fact, probably the book would have been twice the length if they had let me go on my own. I had an editor, Darcy DiNucci, who went through the book very carefully and just ripped out whole sections. I mean, I explained all sorts of things about hard disk drive, and she said, people don't need to know that. They don't need to know about the difference between IDE and SCSI. Forget it. They need to know how many megabytes. They need to know what they're roughly about the speed. They need to know how to shop for a drive, but they don't need the kind of intricacies that you computer nuts tend to put in. So I said, you're right. I backed away. And so the book reflects that kind of sense of everything you need to know, maybe a little more than you absolutely have to know, but not the kind of detail that an expert. This is not the book for somebody who's been using computers for 10 years. I mean, there's lots of excellent advanced books. This is a book for somebody who is just starting, may have started a year ago and wants to learn more, maybe using a computer at work, perhaps has used a computer at work for years but wants to buy a home PC. Real different, you know, wants to learn all the neat things they can do, like going online or using games or you know, getting their finances in order. This is a book to empower people to use a computer regardless of whether they're technically inclined or not.
I think your image of the person who says, gee, I don't know a lot about cars, but I can drive a car. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be really smart to drive a car. And so I think about that in the registration, the old fingernail polish, and the driver's manual, the instruction manual in my car. It doesn't tell me how to remove anything, to fix anything. It tells me just enough so that I can drive the car and maintain it. And if something serious goes wrong, I got to call somebody else.
Well, that's right. And in the book, I talk about that. I talk about a number of things, what we call the computer buddy, and how to sort of get resources when you need them. Clearly, I can't answer every possible question in this book. I mean, no book can. It could be 10,000 pages long. But I talk about, first of all, I talk about other books. I talk about resources that you can call on. That person at work that's a little nerdy and you kind of look at them strange, well, take them out to lunch. Chances are they're a lot nicer than you thought they were, and chances are they're a little lonely. You know, make friends with that computer nerd, and whether it's a he or a she, and have a computer buddy. Get a magazine, but don't get PC Magazine. It's a great magazine for the technically inclined, but get a simple one like PC Novice or PC Computing. Go ahead and join a users group, but make sure the users group is oriented towards beginners or intermediate users. You know, get a relationship with people that can help you. And then also getting back to your car analogy, you know, you can really be a great driver, but if all of a sudden you were plopped down, let's say you got off a plane, you rented a car, and you were in Detroit, and you didn't know Detroit. Well, you may know a lot about how to drive a Ford or a Chevy or a Chrysler or a Mercedes, but you need a roadmap on how to get around Detroit. And so even the advanced and intermediate driver, or in this case computer user, still needs a roadmap when they're in unfamiliar territory. So when you're dealing with software, for example, you give me a program I've never used before, I'll probably learn it a little more quickly than a novice, but I still have a lot of work to do. So there's an ongoing education. None of us know hardly anything when you consider how much there really is to know about computers.
How many of those of us who are adults are technophobic?
Actually, a survey was done by Dell Computer, which isn't exactly your objective source, but they discovered that, I can't remember the exact numbers, but something roughly half the people had some fear of computers. I think it actually might have been higher than that. That may have been the number of people who were afraid of VCRs. But in any case, it was a surprising number of people when they did a random survey nationally. And I think they hired some graduate students to do it, so it may have been done with a little bit of technical accuracy. Surprising number. And then if you look at the sales of my book and some of the other beginning books, my book got onto a bestseller list 2 months after it came out, which is really phenomenal. Other books like DOS for Dummies and PCs for Dummies, which are competitive books, have been on the bestseller list since they came out, you know, over a year ago. Beginning books are the highest sales volume of any computer books in the bookstores. And we're not talking about just computer bestseller lists. I mean, this book is actually getting on to the best-selling trade paperback list because computers are important. Lots of people need to use them. And people are hungry for a simple, friendly way to learn how to use them. So there's obviously a very, very large number of people in this country and clearly abroad that have a lot to learn about computers, or at least feel they have a lot to learn about computers.
You know, when we talk about computer users, a lot of times we look at the sales of computers themselves, and sometimes we look at the sales of application software, but normally it's how many computers are going off the shelf. And frankly, I know a lot of people who their firm bought them a computer and it's sitting in their office, and it may sit in their office for 2 years before they turn it on. When they use it, a better indicator may be when they buy a book like this.
Well, it's funny. In the software industry, we talk about something called shelfware, where somebody will say, we've sold 10 million copies. Well, nobody sold 10 million copies. We've sold 100,000 copies and say, okay, but how many have been used? And, you know, I have programs that have been on my shelf for years, and I'm sure that they are part of that statistic that I've never unwrapped. And it's true also with computers. There are people who buy computers in their doorsteps. And in the book, I talk about how to set up a computer and the fact that you may be sitting there looking at a box that you've been afraid to open. I even talk about how to open the box and, you know, how to get it running, because, you know, the only way it's going to do you any good is if you plug it in and turn it on. Hopefully before it becomes obsolete. You may as well hurry up to do that, because if you wait long enough, it's not going to be worth plugging in. So enjoy it while it's still state-of-the-art.
Well, the review of your book in the Washington Post said that it assumes that the reader knows absolutely nothing. And I said, oh, come on, they must understand something. And you didn't get to how do you turn it on for 3 chapters. So that was a remarkable restraint.
Yeah, it took a lot of work to do that. Of course, I wanted to just jump in there and tell what to do. But sure, we talk about, my editors helped me. It was a group effort. But in the book, I talk about, you know, what a computer is and why you might want to use it. And I talk about all the things you need to do to get to know, like magazines. And I talk about some of the things about technology, like what a monitor is and how they work. I give a lot of buying advice, you know, and a lot of this is really simple. One of the pieces of buying advice you can't stress enough, you know, you go to a Radio Shack store, a computer store, and they've got their, what seems like a great deal, a 486 computer for $1,500. And in many ways, they are really good, but there's one thing they almost always get you on in these low-end computers. They give you a monitor with like a 0.39 dot pitch, and somebody says, why should I care about that? It looks great. It's running these great graphics. Looks beautiful. Well, these monitors with the 0.39 dot pitches, they do look good in graphics, but try to run word processing on them, and suddenly you've got eye strain. And so one of the things I talk about is make sure you get a monitor that has a 0.28 or lower, the lower the number, the better, dot pitch, and make sure, if you can, it'd be nice if it were non-interlaced. Now, those are kind of technical terms that most people don't even think about, but they're important. They're more important than the megahertz of the CPU or some of the other issues, because they affect your health. They affect how you experience the computer. To me, the two most important components in a computer are the monitor and the keyboard. And these are things that the magazines tend to forget. I mean, occasionally you'll see an article, but the computer junkies among us tend to forget that the computers are really just tools for people. And if you go to the store and buy a wrench, you're going to want a wrench that fits nicely in your hand. It's not just all wrenches basically can do what they do, but some wrenches just feel better. And those are the kinds of things that I look for when I shop for a computer. And it's the kind of advice I give in here, and you don't find that advice hardly anywhere else.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Larry Magid. He's a former editor of PC Magazine, and he's the author of The Little PC Book. Now, let me just change topics for a bit. I was reading in Time Magazine about your work on the Polyclos kidnap case. Tell us about how you became involved and what part you played.
It's really interesting. You know, I have two kids myself. One of them is 9 and one of them is 7, so they're both younger than Polly would have been had she lived. And I was driving my car on my way to a meeting in San Jose, which happens to be south. I live in sort of the mid-peninsula between San Francisco and San Jose. And I was driving myself car south on 101, and I was listening to a radio show about this case, and I became very emotional. I really did start crying, and I started thinking about my kids and just how awful it was. And I had this emotional impact. I had this emotional impulse to turn my car around and drive the 100 miles or so north to Petaluma to help out. I wanted to do what I could. And I thought about it for a minute. And I said, well, if I did go to Petaluma, what would I do? I'd probably pass out flyers with Polly's picture on them. And then I realized that I don't have to go to Petaluma to pass out flyers with Polly's picture on them. So before I went anywhere, I picked up my car phone, and I called the Polyclos hotline because they were announcing the number on the radio. And I got a hold of Gary French, who is now the president of the Polyclos Foundation, which is continuing to operate, even though, of course, she is dead and they're not looking for her anymore. And by the time I got home, an hour later, Gary had arranged to have images of Polly and images of her abductor sent to me via email, because they had already scanned them. So working, and at the same time, what was interesting is I got home, I started putting these together using a desktop publishing program. A minute later, I get a call from this guy across the bay from me in Fremont, about 40 miles from where I live, who had the same idea. So we started working together. He and I both had email systems, so I sent him some images and he did things. And we actually collaborated back and forth via electronic mail, and about 20 minutes later, we had a poster. At that point, we have an electronic version of the poster. Now what do you do with it? Well, he put it on his bulletin board, computer bulletin board, and I contacted Prodigy America Online and CompuServe and immediately made arrangements to post it on America Online and CompuServe. I write a column that appears in the San Jose Mercury, and the San Jose Mercury has a relationship with America Online, so we put it up there. And the posters came up, and it actually sort of became part of the Polyclos story. Time Magazine and a number of other newspapers and radio and television shows reported on this. As a result of that, I began to get phone calls from around the country from other parents and grandparents and people involved in other cases begging me to help them, offering me money and really saying, you know, we got to help this. And I said, well, I'd like to, but this isn't really, I'm not really set up for this. So I called up Ernie Allen, who's the executive director of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and we pulled together a meeting in Washington where we got representatives from all the major online services, CompuServe, America Online, Genie, Prodigy, the Internet, actually the National Science Foundation, which helps organize the Internet, and all agreed that they would have permanent archives, permanent forums for finding missing children. And I'm pleased to say that Prodigy and CompuServe have their forums up now. America Online will have it up shortly. And Netcom, which is an Internet provider, will soon have a forum so that the next time a child is missing, or even now there are children missing, you'll be able to log on to these services and get photographs and descriptions that you can then print out and distribute at your local bookstores and, you know, bulletin boards, schools, wherever. We didn't find Polyclos, regrettably. At least we didn't find her alive, and it's very sad. But I have no doubt that other children will be found because of this. And I think it's a very appropriate use of the technology. I also feel that it's appropriate for the online services to pay back something. You know, they're in the business to make money. But just as radio stations, whether public stations or commercial stations, have a certain obligation to do public service, television, newspapers, the online industry needs to take that seriously also. So part of my reason for doing this is not simply to find missing children, as laudable as that goal is, but to really say to the online community, you've got a responsibility. This is an important medium. This isn't just a commercial enterprise. This is a growing, emerging medium which is going to have a huge impact, probably as much as television or radio and newspapers. So you've got to do something. And I'm calling for not just this effort, but I'm calling for other efforts. One of the things I'm calling for is a 911 access so that when you log on to a online services, if you're not a subscriber, use 911 as your account name, and it automatically gets you into a limited area where there's emergency information. Just like you go to a payphone and dial 911, you don't have to have a dime or 20 cents or a quarter to call 911 from a payphone. Even if you have a car phone, you don't have to pay to make a 911 call. it seems to me that the online services ought to be providing this as a public service, this kind of information to people, even if they don't happen to be subscribers. So I'm sort of on a one-person campaign, and it's beginning to build some steam, to really make the online services sort of socially responsible. And I must say I'm getting very little resistance. The services have so far been very cooperative. In fact, they enthusiastically endorsed this Missing Children's Initiative, and there's been a lot of support from the industry.
This is one of those examples of how there's an information infrastructure in this country where information can truly flow outside the control of most businesses and government and formal structures. If people have access, and more people are getting access and being involved, so information can flow more than over the major networks and over the telephone and that type of thing.
Sure. Well, you know, even if you look even at talk radio, you've got to be able to get through. I mean, only so many people can get through to Larry King or Rush Limbaugh or whoever mm-hmm. it is. With the online services, the bandwidth is potentially unlimited. Now, there is a problem now because we're using telephones as our vehicle for transmitting. But even there, tens of thousands of people can get through on a forum on CompuServe or Prodigy or America Online or Internet Bulletin Boards. In fact, millions of people still could. So you have enormous bandwidth. You're not limited by the kind of the sort of serial bandwidth that you have on radio and television where you can only carry one program at a time per channel. With online services, you can have just a tremendous amount of interaction. So it really is a very democratizing impact on media when you think about it. You no longer need the Larry Kings of the world to moderate. You may still have people like that who sort of, in fact, I play a role like that on Prodigy where I do a column and I kind of answer questions. But the real stars of that show, if you will, are the literally thousands of people who contribute. And they can continue to operate whether I'm there or not. They don't need me to quote, sort of answer the phone.
Right. I have two children as well, and my tendency is to prevent the worst happening, but I'm not exactly ready for what happens if the worst has happened. You were talking about how they had scanned this picture in, and I can understand scanning the sketch in, but when you scan a picture in, it's only as good as the picture.
Yes, of course.
What are the characteristics of a picture that you might have handy in a
Well, it's funny you mention that. I wouldn't have known how to answer this question had I not visited the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, but I actually got some lessons while I was there. The way in which you find people is by particular characteristics. If I look at your face, I mean, on the surface I see an attractive-looking woman with blonde hair. But if I look closely enough, I see little, you know, peculiarities. I don't mean to say you have an unusual.
You started out great, Larry.
Yeah, you know, but everybody has a certain, whether your nose or your teeth, yeah. And it's to pay attention to these things, whether it's the way your ears are shaped or the way your nose or just the details, the eyebrows, things and things that can't change. For example, hairstyle or color obviously can be changed very easily. Beards on men, when you're talking about adults, but to pay attention to the things that just are permanent, your chin. Mm-hmm. And, of course, even like how much fat you have on your body can change as well. So you got to watch for that. And these characteristics don't change as you grow. I mean, if you look at a picture of a two-year-old and you look at that same person 5 years later, of course they're going to look radically different, but there are certain characteristics that tend to stay the same. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has technology that they actually can age photographs, and they're very accurate. They can take a photograph, scan it, and then they can manipulate that to show what that person might look like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years from now, even an infant. It's amazing. Now, what I recommend to parents is, A, you have some good, clear photographs of your children, both color and black and white, although color photographs can be made into black and white. And ideally, you should have them scanned. Mill Valley, California, which is a town in Marin County, which is just south of Petaluma, has a program now where they are actually encouraging children, parents to bring in photographs of their children. They're scanning them. And they're putting them into a database. So God forbid if a child is kidnapped, they can have an instantaneous access to that image. And it makes sense to me. It's something I haven't done it yet, but I'm thinking maybe I will have my kids' pictures scanned. You can take them to copy shops like Kinko's and Copy Mat and those various kinds of copy shops. They all have scanners. And you could have them create a TIFF file, which is a file that could be read by either a IBM compatible or a Macintosh. Wouldn't be a bad idea to have it on a disk just in case.
And we all know now the time is of the essence.
Absolutely. 48 hours. I mean, the sad part about this whole thing with polyclass is the experts I spoke with told me, you know, everybody was being optimistic and being hopeful, and that's all you can be, and you should be. But the experts admitted to me that the reality is that after 48 hours, the odds of recovering a child, or actually maybe it's 72 hours, but after two or three days, the odds of recovering a child go way, way down. There are cases where children have been recovered after years, but statistically, you're much more likely to find them in the first 72 hours. So time is of the essence.
My guest today is Larry Magid. He writes the syndicated column Computer File, which appears in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and numerous other publications worldwide. He's also the editor-at-large of Computer Currents. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Larry, what do you see as the major changes in our individual lives over the next 10 years due to computer and information technology?
I think the biggest change is probably going to take place because of the so-called digital highway or the online information systems that are emerging. Right now, there's only maybe, I estimate 3 to 4 million Americans that are using online services for a home. There are probably more at work if you count local area networks. But that's going to mushroom. That's going to become, 10, 20, 30 times that size within a few years. And I think that's going to mean that geographic borders, as we now know them, become increasingly irrelevant. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons I take this somewhat contrarian position of supporting the Clinton administration's initiative. I think government does have a legitimate role, not in so-called regulating this highway, but at least fostering it along and helping to make sure that it takes place in a healthy way. This is somewhat of a diversion, but I recently wrote a column that appeared in San Jose Mercury News. I also do a Sunday column for them on communications where I datelined it January 2nd, 1908. And I started off and said, President Roosevelt is in the White House, and later this year, Henry Ford will release the Model T. Vice President Charles Fairbanks is about to address the nation on the national transportation policy. He wants to encourage a policy where industry is encouraged to develop cars, but cars that are safe, that are environmentally friendly, that are not going to have an adverse effect on our cities. And he's also thinking about the day when America's auto industry is going to have to compete with automakers in other parts of the world. And of course, I go on to say that this speech never took place. But in reality, our current Vice President, Al Gore, will give a speech and has been giving speeches to try to create a national data information highway. And I think that's all for the good. That doesn't mean I'm going to endorse everything he comes up with, and doesn't mean that we don't have to be careful to make sure government doesn't, take control over this. But it does mean that just as the government has a role in protecting people's health, we have meat inspectors and health inspectors at restaurants, there may be a need to protect or help foster this highway in a way that's progressive and environmentally responsible, in a way that makes it affordable. So I think it's, in answer to your question, that's going to have a huge impact as people begin to discover that that this highway that's being paved right now, not with blacktop but with fiber and wireless and cable, is going to be a very important road to be on. And to know how to travel that road and to make sure you have access to that road and all of its many by lanes and stops along the way is going to probably be a major determinant of who is in and who is out in the next century. Money will still be here, and money will ultimately be what determines the haves and the have-nots. But there will be information have-nots. There will be education have-nots. There will be children who excel and children who fail to excel. And some of it will be determined. I don't want to romanticize it because all the other issues still exist. There's hunger, there's poverty, there's nutrition, there's all the things that still affect us. But this is going to have a big impact. And I'm excited about it. I'm really excited about it. And I'm really, I for one, am really glad that we have an administration in the White House, whether you like them or not on all their other issues, that's willing to put this in the front burner. I get a lot of nasty mail. A lot of libertarians in this country write to me and say, no, the government should play no role. No role in this at all. It should laissez-faire. And I think about the robber barons of the oil industry, and I think about the auto industry. I think about the meatpacking plants. I think about why we had labor unions. We may or may not need labor unions today, but we certainly needed them in the 20s and 30s. I think about all that. And I say, yes, government does have a role. And there is something that has to be done to protect the people, to represent the interests of the people. And the other aspect of this is to think about the fact that the Internet doesn't have border patrols. People worry about illegal aliens, and they worry about smuggling, right? You have this image of these people coming over the Mexican border. That ain't nothing compared to what you can do on the Internet. Here's an example. 60 Minutes did a program a number of months ago where they exposed how Hewlett-Packard and other computer companies are hiring Russian and other Eastern European programmers. They're bringing them over here. They're paying them maybe a third of what an American programmer would pay, and they're putting them in these what they call body shops and having them write programs. why couldn't those people still be in Russia and be paid a tenth of what we pay? I mean, even the $20,000 that they're getting to write programs in sweatshops in America is more than they would get over in Russia or India, where they live. When you pick up the phone to call up information to make an airline reservation, what's to stop that operator from being in Haiti or India or China or anywhere where they can simply speak English? So the government has a role. I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily bad, but if we're worried about jobs going south or east or north or whatever...
Look at technology.
If we're worried about smuggling, what's to stop somebody from in any country in this world from smuggling software into the United States and avoiding duty, avoiding all these things? If you're worried about these things, and I think we should be concerned about them, then I think don't look so much at the Mexican border. Start looking at the Internet. And I love the Internet. I think it's great. But again, government has some reason to be concerned. That doesn't mean I want government snooping into my computer by any stretch of the imagination. But I think that the government has a role in helping to shape what it's going to look like.
If we look 10 years down the line, I'm always looking at what's in a standard person's household budget. And looking back 100 years, people say, oh, the car insurance is too much and the health insurance is too much. It's like, well, they certainly weren't in your budget 100 years ago.
Yeah.
10 years from now, your online access fees
absolutely
would be a part of every family's budget.
That's right. Mine are enormous, actually. And I have another book coming out, by the way, in February called Cruising the Digital Highways, Larry Maggott Online, and it's from Random House, and it's all about these online systems. And you, I talk in there about how to save money and how not to, to go broke, because you can. It's like a credit card or a long distance call. Sure, look at long distance. I mean, I know many people who spend over $100 a month on personal phone calls. My grandmother didn't spend $100 a month on personal phone calls. I don't even know she had a phone until she was, you know, into her 50s. It is going to be a factor. I guess the question is, are we going to have income that rises to offset it? Are we going to have other expenses that, that decrease? For example, my phone bills are enormous, but because I work at home, my dry cleaning bill is almost non-existent. My transportation bills are extremely low because I don't have to commute. You know, so there are other... My food bills are lower because I don't have to eat lunch in restaurants. So if you look at the thousands of dollars that I'm saving on gasoline, lunches, and dry cleaning, it probably makes up for the hundreds of dollars additional that I spend on telephones and online and fax and whatever. So you really have to look at the counterbalances. It's more of a shift than I think an actual necessarily net increase in our expenditures.
Okay, now you said we had a cartoon in the book.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You wanted me to read.
Well, it's on page 35, and what I need you to do is to sort of explain the graphic and then read the text of it.
Okay, so here are two people looking at this, and one's a fellow with a baseball cap, and one's a gal with pretty good-looking hair and long earrings, and they're on either side of a very, very large computer board, lots of chips and all kinds of things wired all together here. And the fellow says, the system board, or motherboard, is the brains of the computer. And then the gal says, it's called the motherboard because it does most of the work. Well, I appreciate that, Larry.
You see, the little PC book not only stands for personal computer, but it's a politically correct little PC book. Two meanings.
That's terrific. Larry, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest today has been Larry Maggott. His new book is The Little PC Book, published by Peach Pit Press. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.